Okay, good morning. Starting a little bit late so that these sheets could get around. And again, one of them is, the first one was the Acts Lesson 8a and Lesson 8b. If you're collecting these, questions and answers. For those of you visiting or here once in a while, we are not discussing these. Unless you have a question on there that, or a question jumps out at you, you're wondering about, you want to discuss it. But I hand these out anyway because some of you like to use that as a tool, and some of you don't. So we're not going over those in class. And the other one I handed out was Acts 10. Cornelius converted. So if you want to memorize that heading, I'm encouraging us to memorize each heading so that we have an idea of what's in each chapter. So I understand you worked through Acts 9 last week. Which I'm assuming you focused on the content there and what Peter was doing. He performs a couple of miracles, didn't he? At least that are recorded. Which might raise the question of what are the purpose of the miracles which we've dealt with. But I thought this was kind of interesting here in that there, if you look through the Bible, Genesis to Revelation, there are definite periods of time where there seem to be more miracles performed than at other times. Now, at the times that we don't have recorded in our Bibles, that miracles may have taken place, but we just don't have them recorded. But what we do see is during the time of Moses, we see he was given power, obviously, to establish God's authority. And one of the big examples of his work was bringing the Israelites out of Egypt, correct? A lot of power to through God, working through him, to open that Red Sea. And then the miracle getting through the Red Sea. And then striking the rock and bringing water and manna coming down from heaven, all those things that God worked through Moses, specifically to authenticate Moses as God's servant. And Moses is the one that wrote, "Listen to me, but there's a prophet in the future like me, a lawgiver and a prophet. Listen to him." That's what Moses wrote down. Then we have a time period when Israel was in Canaan and on their downward slide, you might say, and God sent Elijah and Elisha. There were other prophets after them. We don't have written what we call books with their names on it, but they are what they did are found in which books in the Old Testament? Samuel and Kings. And they were to give testimony to Israel. And the other purpose was to awaken the nation in the midst of apostasy. And I'll put that in there. Then we get down and start reading our New Testaments, and we find that Christ, obviously, and the apostles worked miracles, signs, wonders, and miracles. A lot of that was to fulfill scriptural prophecy. That's the way Jesus used a lot of it. And to validate their message in character / character, validate their message, their character of, we're talking about Christ and his apostles. And you see in Acts here, we see this happening quite a bit. Here Peter performed some miracles, but they've already done that previously, like the lame man, for example. Not for entertainment, not for the goal that Simon in Samaria wanted, not for money, but to validate their message. I am from God, I'm approved from God. What I'm saying is approved from God. And the preliminary effect of miracles and signs and wonders was attention, wasn't it? Creating an audience, the audience come together, and then that message was spoken. So great example of that in Acts chapter 9. Plus, did you discuss the effects of Tabitha's work and her example there last week?
Not a lot.
Not a lot, but a little bit. Okay. Everybody got their Bibles open? Kind of looks like it. Let's go to Acts 10. I like to get you guys involved in a way. If you don't feel like reading, just say pass. Or I pass, or I'd rather not. And I usually choose men because their voices, they're more obnoxious and louder than men are. So men have a tendency to project a little better, so. And 60% of this group is deaf, including me. So hard of hearing. Kramer, you want to belt out a few verses out of 10? So let's go chapter 10. First of all, where's Peter as far as his location? Yeah, Joppa. That's from 9:43. That's where I get that. Okay, 10 through verse 8, please. Patrick?
Now there was a certain man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort, a devout man, one who feared God with all his household, and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. About the ninth hour of the day, he clearly saw in a vision an angel of God who had just come into him and said to him, Cornelius. Fixing his gaze upon him and being much alarmed, he said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. And now dispatch men to Joppa and send for a man named Simon, who is also called Peter. He is staying with a certain tanner named Simon, whose house is by the sea. And when the angel who was speaking to him had departed, he summoned two of his servants,
thank you. All right, Carm, could you take us down to through 16, please?
The next day, as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up to the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. Then he became very hungry and wanted to eat, but while he made ready, he fell into a trance and saw heaven open and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And a voice came to him, Rise, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean. And a voice spoke to him again the second time, What God has cleansed, you must not call common. This was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again.
Thank you. Hey, Dwayne, would you mind reading? 17 down through 23.
And while Peter was greatly perplexed in mind as to what the vision which he had seen might be, behold, the men who had been sent by Cornelius, having asked directions for Simon's home, appeared at the gate. And calling out, they were asking whether Simon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. What verse?
Down to 23.
And while Peter was reflecting on the vision, the Spirit said to him, Three men are looking for you. But rise, go downstairs and accompany them without misgivings, for I have sent them myself. And Peter went down to the man and said, Behold, I am the one you are looking for. What is the reason for which you have come? And they said, Cornelius, centurion, the righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of, by the entire nation of the Jews, was divinely directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to this home and hear a message from you. And so he invited them and gave them lodging.
All right. Keep going.
And the next day he arose and went away with them, and some of the brothers.
Thank you. My publishers put in a little comment in there, and it split the verse. Okay, Lane, 24, please, down to 20 through 29. Okay. Nathan, could you take it down to 33?
Cornelius said, 4 days ago to this hour, I was praying in my house during the ninth hour, and behold, a man stood before me in shining garments, and he said, Cornelius, your prayer has been heard, and your alms have been remembered before God. Therefore, send to Joppa and invite Simon, who is also called Peter, to come to you. He is staying at the house of Simon the Tanner by the sea. So I sent for you immediately, and you have been kind enough to come. Now then, we are all here, present before God, to hear all that you have been commanded by the Lord.
All right, so hopefully we were following along with that and could hear that and or listening to it. And that is a picture of some nudging, isn't it? Nudging, the Spirit nudging Cornelius, and the Spirit nudging Peter and bringing them together. I'd like to read something from a writer. Doesn't mean we have to agree with his application, but just briefly, tune into this for a moment, will you? In the spring of 1992, violence inflamed the city of Los Angeles. When the smoke finally cleared, an estimated 5,200 buildings were destroyed or damaged, and losses ranged close to $1 billion. A staggering number of people were arrested, almost 17,000. The number of injured soared to 2,383, and the death bell tolled a tragic 54 times. What could have fueled such a destructive rampage? In speculating about the many possible causes for the riots, we can sift through the city's rubble and uncover a major flashpoint: prejudice. Differences in color and culture had ignited misunderstanding, which had sparked antagonism, which had inflamed hatred, then anger, then revenge. The result was 36 hours of havoc and bloodshed. We shake our heads at such horrible violence, but admit it or not, we all have that same volatile prejudice smoldering within us. According to Webster's, prejudice is simply a, quote, preconceived judgment. Do you see yourself a tendency to prejudge others? Do you see in yourself? Take a moment for a quick personal prejudice test. What images come to mind when you think of blacks or whites or Hispanics or Asians? How about those who are poor or those who are wealthy? Do you categorize people by the length of their hair, or the cosmetics they wear or don't wear? Politically, what about liberals, conservatives? How do you feel about people who have failed, who are divorced, who have been in psychiatric hospitals? What about religious prejudice? How do you view those who attend, and as he says it, a different church, who worship differently than you do, or who have a different list of do's and don'ts? It's painful to face our own prejudices, and like being trapped in a smoke-filled building, it's hard to see through the negative preconceptions we've had all our lives. We're not alone, for the Apostle Peter was trapped by prejudice too. And this guy's writing about Acts, so he says, let's watch how God rescues him as we begin this study in Acts here. So he throws out a few practical things to chew on concerning. He's highlighting the idea of preconceived judgments or prejudice out of this chapter 9 and 10. Does anybody know what the Mishnah is?
Yes.
What is it, Barbara?
It's the oral teaching of the Jews.
Yeah. Does anybody remember when it was started being compiled? I think a particular rabbi started writing it down. Was it like 200 AD?
I don't know that. I just know the word and know what it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are a lot of teachings. I got into it with the catechism. One guy with a Catholic woman.
Yeah.
She was upset because Holy Family was not teaching the Baltimore Catechism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why? I didn't know anything about that. So I went to the library and found out Martin Luther started catechism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the reason I bring up the Mishnah is this guy, another guy, Alfred Eldersheim, describes the extent of the inbred prejudice that Jews held against Gentiles. Now, if it was compiled and written down after what we're reading here in Acts, it's still connected to that period from when the Old Testament, in the 500s, when we have what we call the silence of the Scriptures, and traditions and things started being compiled, and Pharisees had a lot to do with that, and written down oral traditions. They say, oh, it's not new law. That's how they emphasize that fact. Oh, it's not new law, but yet it was so entrenched, and these rabbis taught it over and over. It became law, a lot of this. But this is what one guy, Edersheim, describes the extent of inbred prejudice, and here's a quote from him. Every Gentile child, so soon as born, was to be regarded as unclean. The Jews were to regard a Gentile child, baby, as unclean if they saw one or around it or knew about it. The Mishnah goes so far as to forbid aid to a Gentile mother in the hour of her need or nourishment to her babe, in order not to bring up a child for idolatry. It was not safe to leave cattle in their charge, in the charge of a Gentile, to allow their women to nurse infants, or their physicians to attend the sick, nor to walk in their company. They and theirs were defiled, their houses unclean, as containing idols or things dedicated to them. Their feasts, that means the Gentiles' feasts, their joyous occasions, their very contact was polluted by idolatry. And there was no security, even if a heathen were left alone in a room, that he might not defile the wine or meat on the table or the oil and wheat in the store. Just by being in a room with this stuff, in the Jews' eyes, was making everything unclean. Milk drawn by a heathen, if a Jew had not been present to watch it, bread and oil prepared by them were unlawful. Their wine was wholly interdicted. Is that the word? Interdicted. Their wine was wholly polluted. The mere touch of a heathen polluted a whole cask. Nay, even to put one's nose to heathen wine was strictly prohibited. Okay, see the idea here of this could have been an influence. This type of thinking could have influenced Peter and the rest of his Jewish compatriots, the other apostles, and those that lived during this first century. Things like, well, we see this in the parable of the Samaritan, don't we? Where a fellow was beaten, and obviously he must have been a Gentile. Does it tell us that? The one that was beaten? Did Jesus say that? Because the two Jews walked by, didn't want to have anything to do with them. I don't think it does. The main focus is that Samaritan, whom the Jews also looked down upon, they almost treated the Samaritans as Gentiles, really. He's the one that helped the guy in the ditch. Probably, yeah, now that I think about it, the one that was beaten doesn't tell us whether he's a Gentile. But there was definitely prejudice there. The Jesus' apostles even wondered why he was speaking with the woman at the well. Of course, She was a woman. And the Samaritans are kind of in a different category. And Peter has already been in Samaria and been teaching to Samaria. As we go through Acts, he's already been into that area. So obviously he didn't look upon the Samaritans quite like he would look at this Cornelius. And Peter's going, as we read here, Peter's going to go into this trance and see this vision. Just before he meets Cornelius, he has no idea what's coming at him. But he's thinking about it. He's definitely thinking about it. So let's go back to the intervention with Cornelius. And what is this? Who is this guy named Cornelius? And the only thing I read, the only reason I read about that Jewish prejudice is to kind of put you in Peter's shoes when we get to where the Spirit needs to nudge him to go and meet with Cornelius. Just think about the prejudgment and the prejudice that the Jews had towards the Gentiles, and we say, "Oh yeah, we know about that." It's a little more descriptive and interesting to think about how deep and entrenched that was in their thinking. Ted? Right.
But not a Jew.
Right.
I can't believe somebody that's supposed to be so knowledgeable would make such an ignorant statement of that. You know?
Yeah.
And another thing that I was going to bring up here before you, sorry, this idea of this vision he had, we don't see anywhere where he actually did get around to eating those things, did he? And that, I mean, he just said it three times that was presented to him, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how you would eat something out of a trance, but...
Yeah, unless you did in a trance.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah. Well, we'll get to him. I wanted to read that most of this chapter to get an overall context of it, and then we'll see how he reacted to that and discuss it a little more. Kel? That's right.
I'm just a little uncomfortable with the word prejudice, the way we conceive it today compared to Peter's situation.
In some ways it fits perfectly, in some ways that word may not work well. It is accurate that the law will go all the way back to here, and we can read through Leviticus and Numbers, and there's definitely things that were clean to them and unclean, and those traditions handed down, the law handed down. Peter obviously knew about those things because now he says later to Cornelius that, you know, that it's unlawful for me to enter or visit a Gentile. I don't know if that was in the old law. There was probably a compilation of things, the old law and their traditions that... Well, let's put it this way, Kel, that the way their attitude, I don't think would have been approved by God. The attitude of this intense hatred for these people.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Now, whether Peter had that or not, I don't know. But it's what was wrong was the intense hatred and the way they treated them. That wasn't in the law of Moses. But they were to have certain things clean and there were unclean things and all of this. And that's why Peter, that sheet had to come down three times, which we'll get to. Barb? Yeah.
Half-breed of anything.
That's why I mentioned the woman at the well there. And
I tell you, people don't realize that intense hatred
right.
that they have for those people. Now, there are people that have hatred against certain people.
Right.
And particularly, I don't know why it is, but it is the cross-breeding of things, and we will notice that you can mate a donkey and a horse, but a pure mule, the workhorse of all animals, is not allowed to have babies because God's rules said don't intermingle with certain things, and this is what the Jews had, and they hated you.
Yeah. Yeah, what we gotta think about, meditate upon is the source of that hatred, and we gotta distinguish between what was in the old law and what they were told to consider clean and unclean, and distinguish that from what that developed into over the years, coming down into the time of Jesus and the Pharisees, and the way and the things they piled on top of the law and the prejudices they developed and the hatred that wasn't in the old law. Do you see what I'm saying here? Distinguish between those things, which takes some time. I mean, we don't have time to study all the laws in the Old Testament and then go back into this and figure it out. And we just don't have all the details here as to what was in Peter's mind and even his background, how much he knew of the old law and how much was tradition and Jewish tradition that he was following. So just keep those things in mind as we go through here. What type of character was there anything else on that? What type of character was Cornelius? What was he? Huh? Yeah. Devout. What's devout mean? What's devoted mean? Devout? What's devout mean?
He was one who devoted himself to religious matters, if we'll put it that way, to God in a better way.
Yeah. If he was a proselyte following Jewish law and whatever, I don't know if Peter would have had a problem going to him, but he must have had some influence. He knew a little bit about law supposedly and God. Devout meaning, does somebody throw a, is that in some of these translations? Man, my pages. I'm looking at chapter 9, no wonder I'm not. Yeah, verse 2, a devout man who feared God, devoted to... What were some of the definitions you threw out on devout? Huh? God-fearing, dedicated. Ted? Right. Yeah. And Peter's the one that said that, and it's just gradually and eventually dawns on him. Whoa! Wow! What? But I don't think he realized what he was when he quoted Joel back there. He didn't realize all the implications. Yeah. Yeah. So he's a devout man, devoted, dedicated. He feared God. He had respect for God with all his household. Gave many alms. What's that? Gifts. Yep, gifts of charity to the Jewish people, and prayed to God continuously. Okay. I'm going to write that down here. Out of my notes. Woo! Do I need to leave this up here? This is the eras of miracles. Not to say that there weren't miracles in between there, but really when you think about it, what we have recorded, there's not a whole lot of miracles from Genesis to Revelation. They kind of fall into these three areas from what we have recorded. It's kind of interesting. So I'm going to get rid of that so I can put Cornelius up here. All right, Cornelius was devout, and he feared God. He had fear, respect. He gave alms or gifts of charity, and he prayed. All right, this is Cornelius. We're calling a Gentile. He is a centurion. So just keep this in mind here. These first two things up here is what he was. This is character. These two things down here describe what he did. Yeah. What he was and what he did. Okay. Right. All his house was also feared God and was devoted. So that indicates that he's a leader. This isn't by accident. He's a leader. Centurion was usually a leader over how many men? About 100. Yep. So in the ninth hour, anything else we need to pull out of that? Ninth hour of the day is what time of day in our clock? 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He clearly saw in a vision an angel of God who had just come in and said to him, Cornelius. Would that startle you, Kara? If you're in your room at the mirror, Kara's working on her eyes and everything, and then somebody behind her says, Kara, she'd jump right through the mirror, right? Oh boy, Cornelius, and fixing his gaze on him and being much alarmed, said, what is it, Lord? How's he using the term Lord here?
Someone that's stronger.
Yeah, you're in control in this situation right here, and I'm listening. It was a term of respect.
Someone greater than
exactly, and he recognized that. And it was, how did it describe it? An angel. And whether Cornelius thought, oh, I'm talking to an angel or not, I don't know, but he recognized that he needed to pay attention and said, what is it, Lord? Humbled himself, you might say. And the angel answers him. Joyce.
Well, this isn't about Cornelius.
Oh.
I was in a hospital. I was having a breathing test, which is pretty lengthy, ward known. And this man that was administering this to me, just out of the clear blue, said, do you believe in visions? And I said, well, the Bible certainly talks about them. And he said, well, I have to tell you a story. He said, about a month ago, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I know I was awake. I was not dreaming. And the room was dark, and it was like a portrait of his grandmother who had raised him.
Uh-huh.
And it was just from my chest high, he described her. It was just like a picture. And she afraid. You need to get back to God.
Hmm.
That was his name, Gray.
Mm-hmm.
And he said as quick as she came, she was gone. And he said, I woke my wife up and I just shook her and shook her and shook her and woke her up out of a dead sleep. And I said to her, we are going to get back to God. We're going to start going to church. And he says, and I've been faithful ever since.
Huh.
But it was just like out of the clear blue, he decided to tell me this story.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I was a praying person, and I said, yes. Well, that was the first thing he asked me, and then he told me about that.
Uh-huh.
But he was wanting to ask me to pray for his little niece who was going to have a heart surgery, and she was less than 2 years old.
Yeah. Well, there, I guess, number one, that could be an example of a vision. Number two, it's also, in this context, speaking of prejudice, many of us, first time we hear that story, we prejudge and think, oh, this fella, he's something's a little quacky, you know, a little nuts. I'm just saying that when Joyce tells that story, that's what a lot of us could be thinking. Oh, that can't happen. That can't be. I'm not commenting one way or another on that, whether it really happened or not. I'm not going to judge his motives, but just you bringing up that story is an interesting when we're talking about prejudging and prejudice and everything. Yeah, it's very interesting. So this is what Cornelius is experiencing. And the angel says, your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. What does a memorial do?
Bring back memory.
Yes, brings one's memory back to something. Well, did God forget something?
No, but he made a promise.
He didn't forget anything. He did make a... It's like the... we go to Washington, D.C. I haven't been there. How many of you have been there? Yeah. Are there a few memorials around there? Monuments? You go to the Lincoln Memorial. What does that bring you back to? The Civil War, yeah. Some of his words and some of his wisdom, if you look at it that way. Yeah. Those monuments tend to do that. You're not... You know, Lane will look at a monument and he'd be thinking about a Philly cheesesteak. That where can he find something to eat? But most of us look at a monument and we're going to be brought back to a particular event or words that person did, huh?
It's not that you forgot Lincoln.
Right.
But it reminds you of things that have a connection with
him. Right.
God didn't
forget anything. But what promise are you talking about, Kel?
He'll clear back his promise to Abraham that all nations of the earth will be blessed.
Right. All the nations of the earth would be blessed. That was the promise. This memorial thing again. When I say to Randy, Lisa, what do you think of? Yeah. Who is that? She's not here right now.
Well, I can say what I want.
Have you forgotten that you're married? It's not that Randy's. It's not that Randy's forgotten that he's married, right? It just brings to mind that name. Just brings to mind. Yeah, his wife's name's Lisa. But it's not as if he hasn't forgotten who he is and he's been married. How long have you guys been married?
29.
Yeah. So see, me just saying that name just brings back to the rest of us what he's all about. He's a married man. But again, God hasn't forgotten anything. It's just there's a promise he made years and years and years ago. Specifically to what individual?
Abraham.
This is hundreds, this is thousands of years, isn't it? And And right now, he's talking to Cornelius, who's a Gentile. God's been dealing for hundreds of years with a specific people that he called out of Egypt, gave a law to. Doesn't mean he had nothing to do and didn't interact with any of the other Gentile nations, but as far as giving them a covenant, giving them a place that they were to build a temple where he'd put his name there and focus, all that focus on that, on that nation. And now, this promise of bringing in all the nations, promise to Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And here we're seeing it open up and happen. Ward and then Kel.
Yeah, for those that have trouble understanding your explanation of a memorial, we'll be illustrating one a little bit later in the worship service.
Right. Yep, Kel?
Well, two things. And Abraham wasn't a Jew. Promise was made to him before the Jews. And I was just looking at those words up there. I would love to be described by people with those. I would love for them to be able to say, Kelly is devout to fear God and gave generously to charity and pray. That, those are beautiful things. That's a beautiful way to be remembered.
It is, isn't it? And he wasn't a Jew. Yeah, he wasn't a Jew. Okay, so thanks for that input, and we're running out of time. So we'll keep motoring through this next week. Please read the entirety of Acts 10 and go into 11, if you wouldn't mind. Get the whole picture there. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, not necessarily. So in some cases, it's a good thing, but
right.
In other cases.
Like when we go into a cemetery, that's the end of somebody's life,
yeah.
And that's all that's left.
Or a legacy, or
yeah.
What have you. It covers a broad
right.
spectrum of things.
Right.
All living things as we do.
That's right. And here, it's really kind of the